Ku Iluna, please rise.
Ua ho'o malolo ia mai ne ke a aha ho'o kolo kolo ki'e ki'e hano hano.
This Honorable Supreme Court is now reconvened. Inoho ilalo, please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCAP-22-552. Stephen P. H. Wong versus Association of Apartment Owners of Harbor Square. Arguing for the appellant, Stephen K. S. Chung. Arguing for the appellees, Mary Martin. Also appearing is Carlos Perez Mesa, Dwayne Miyashiro, and James Shin. Argument on the merits.
All right, good afternoon, aloha everyone. Just a reminder, our proceeding today is being broadcast on our YouTube channel, as well as on Olelo. And I'd like to welcome our substitute justices, Judge Paul Wong, and Judge Rowena Somerville, and thank them for being with us today. Counsel, are you both ready to proceed? All right. We've allowed 30 minutes argument for each side. Mr. Chung, you'll have 20 minutes for your opening argument. Reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. So we'll give you a warning 20 minutes in. Ms. Martin, you have 30 minutes. We're going to give you a warning at 5 minutes in. Mr. Chung, please proceed.
Good afternoon. And may it please the court, I'm Stephen Chung. I'm counsel for the petitioner appellant, Stephen Wong, who is also the plaintiff in the underlying case. The issue that in this appeal is whether the amount of a secured debt, a mortgage, owed to a third party should be subtracted from the value of property that is wrongfully taken when calculating the damages that a plaintiff is entitled to recover from the defendant that took the property. In discussing this issue, I will discuss whether the status of the litigants make any difference. And by status, I mean whether the plaintiff or the defendant are saints or sinners. I also will discuss the remedies for conversion and the remedies for wrongful foreclosure as announced by this court in various cases and how they apply to this appeal. And I will also discuss why public policy compels the reversal of the decision of the lower court, which held that in calculating the damages that my client was entitled to recover for the wrongful taking of his apartment, a mortgage owed to a third-party lender that was foreclosed 8 years after the wrongful taking had to be deducted from the value of the apartment. There's a statute called Lady Justice. The statute of Lady Justice wears a blindfold. And the blindfold reminds us that the law, justice, is not biased. The law does not categorize plaintiffs and defendants and administer justice depending upon who they are. Where a plaintiff has property wrongfully taken from them, that plaintiff is entitled to the same remedy, whether that person is financially irresponsible, as happens to be the case here, or is stellar with his financial affairs. And the same is true of a defendant. A defendant is treated equally, no matter a defendant in a wrongful taking case is treated equally, as the court in Freddie Nubrica Enterprises said, doesn't matter whether the property taken was by mistake, deliberate, or by the wrongful mistaken assumption that the defendant had authority to take the property. All defendants are treated the same way, and all plaintiffs are treated the same way. We don't put them into categories, and that's Bynum versus Magno. It says we don't categorize our litigants and administer justice depending upon what their status is. Everyone who comes to court is entitled to the same rights and the same remedies. So this case arises from the unlawful use of 6675, a statute that was enacted in 1874 that allowed a mortgage to be foreclosed and property taken where that mortgage contained a power of sale. It was a very draconian remedy, and that statute was eventually repealed in 2012. Prior to its repeal, That statute was used by a number of associations, such as the respondent in this case, to sell at auction property belonging to apartment owners who had defaulted in paying their common expenses. And these properties were sold for a very nominal amount, as in this case for $1, and then rented by these associations until the lender eventually foreclosed the mortgage.
Mr. Chung, if I could, you know, one of the main questions here is the applicability of this court's Lima decision, where we held, in light of the purpose of compensatory damages, plaintiff borrowers must show that the damages they seek will, quote, restore them to the position they would be in if the wrong had not been committed. And that seemed to animate our analysis in terms of trying to determine or finding that the mortgage debt was should be counted and should be considered in those circumstances. Sure. Doesn't that same sort of policy judgment or the same policies that quote reflects exist in this case as well, of putting the person, in this case your client, back to where they would have been otherwise in, I guess, 2011?
It does, Your Honor, and I'll explain now, and I'll go back and explain again in the order that I attempted, that I had planned to bring this up. So Lima says that compensatory damage is not only in the case of a wrongful foreclosure, but in all cases where a tort occurs. Compensatory damages are intended to put the plaintiff back in the position that they were pre-tort, before the wrong occurred, no matter what that wrong was. In the case of Lima, you're dealing with lenders who had mortgages containing powers of sale, who had the right to do non-judicial foreclosures using 6675, who had given notice of foreclosure, published the intent to foreclose because the borrowers were in default. And in that circumstance, the borrowers had very little pre-foreclosure rights because the lender had already said, you're in default, you know, we're giving you notice, we're going to sell your property.
Mr. Chung, I think we kind of get that, but let's cut to the chase here on Lima. You know, why should the third party mortgage debt here be different than in Lima?
Justice said, the reason is that in Lima, the entity doing the wrongful foreclosure was the lender that was foreclosing its mortgage. And so prior to the foreclosure, the homeowner had a home that was secured by that mortgage. After the foreclosure, both the home and the mortgage were eliminated. So the homeowner no longer was liable on that mortgage.
But compensatory damages are to put someone in the same position. You're basically asking for windfall.
Well, that's what the law over the years provides, Your Honor, for a theft.
Where?
A wrong.
Where have we said that the plaintiff should get a windfall?
Well, the first case that dealt with wrongful foreclosure was Johnson versus Tisdale. In that case, the court said that where a wrongful foreclosure occurs, where the misuse of the power in the mortgage occurs, that constitutes a conversion. And the plaintiff is entitled to a remedy being the fair market value, the whole value of what was taken, minus only what is owed to the creditor that conducted the wrongful foreclosure. In our case, the creditor that conducted the wrongful foreclosure is the association. It did not hold the mortgage. Prior to the foreclosure, my client held an apartment that's subject to a mortgage. After the wrongful foreclosure, he was still liable for that mortgage, but the apartment was gone. So to put him back in his pre-tort position, you have to restore the value of the apartment because he's still liable on the mortgage, and he was liable for the next 8 years until the mortgage was foreclosed.
So why shouldn't the measure of damages be the value of him being able to live there for 8 years until it was actually foreclosed by the lender?
Justice McKinnon, the reason is that conversion damages gives you the election. In Sewer versus Bayer, you have the right to take the value of the property taken from you at the time of the taking, or you can say, give me back the property and disgorge all the profit, the rent that you received at that during your wrongful holding. We've elected to take the value of the property, as Sewer versus Bayer and Rojas versus Marcus says we're entitled to, where there is a wrongful taking.
I'm sorry, which case? Which cases?
Roja versus Marcos, the Marcos case, the Gold Buddha case, both Roja versus Marcos and Sewer versus Bayer and Freddie Nobrega versus the state all deal with conversion, the wrongful taking of property, saying that the damages for the wrongful taking are the value of the property. And Johnson versus Tisdale said the same as Lima, less what is owed to the creditor that commits the wrong, not to some third party creditor. There's a case.
Was there evidence of third party debt in those cases?
Yes, there was. There was a HSBC had the mortgage. There was a mortgage on the apartment that remained in place after the property was taken
by
the association. I'm sorry.
In the other cases that you said.
No. Marcus dealt with a commodity, and right. Sewer versus Baker, Bayer dealt with property. But there is a case on point, a California appellate court case that we referred to in our reply memo in support of our motion for reconsideration called Camp versus Ortega. In Camp versus Ortega, there was property that was mortgaged, that was converted, and the lower court granted judgment for the value of the property less the mortgage. On appeal, the California appellate court reversed and said, the rule is that when property is converted, the plaintiff is entitled to the whole value of the property. You don't subtract the lien that is owed in front of a third party. And the defendant protested, saying that's unfair. It provides a windfall to the plaintiff. And the court said, that's your responsibility for the misconduct that you, for your misconduct. And that's the same rule that is applied in our cases, in Bynum versus Magno and in Roja versus Marcos. The courts are saying where there is wrongdoing and there is some benefit that should redound to the benefit of the plaintiff, not the wrongdoer. In this case, the lower court said, I'm going to subtract the value of this mortgage owed to a third party because, Mr. Wong, you're no longer liable for that 8 years after the property was taken from you, but I'm going to let the association keep 8 years' worth of rental income. The benefit of the lower court's decision redounds to the defendant that commits the wrong, not the plaintiff. The public.
So why shouldn't your damages be the 8 years of the value of not being able to live there? Are you disputing that the rental that they received was not the fair market rental value?
It was about $300,000 that they got to keep, but we elected conversion damages, which is the value of the unit, not the return of the unit and the rental income. So we had to make a choice. We couldn't have it both ways.
Well, didn't the court sort of make the decision for you by saying that you didn't produce any evidence to support, rental disgorgement, let's say?
We provided the purchase price for the unit. We provided the fair market value of the unit. And those are the damages that we are entitled to recover under the Johnson case, under the Suru case, under Roja, and all these other cases dealing with wrongful taking, including Santiago. Right? Santiago says you're entitled to all of your out-of-pocket losses. Out-of-pocket losses came from fraud and deceit cases where you purchased property and you were deceived. It wasn't of the value that you thought it was. And so the earlier cases said out-of-pocket loss is the price paid less the value of what you obtained. That was the original cases, but over the years, the concept of out-of-pocket losses, as explained in the Zanakis-Pico case, which is cited in the Santiago case, is the value of what you parted with. It's not how much you paid.
But, you're saying Santiago, and earlier you were saying, hey, the distinction between this case is you had a third-party lender versus, just a non-judicial foreclosure. But Santiago, it wasn't a defendant bank that own that property, right?
Yeah, but the seller of the inn.
Right, so isn't that the distinction there? I mean, isn't that a meaningful distinction, let's say?
I submit not, Justice Evans. I think that in the Santiago case, what the court said was, we're going to treat this wrongful taking and give you more damages that you would get as conversion damages. We're going to give you all of your out-of-pocket losses, which is the remedy for fraud or deceit. And so whatever you lost on this transaction, you're entitled to recover. There, the Santiago's purchased the property for $1.3 million. They put an $800,000 down payment and $500,000 mortgage in favor of the seller. And they were making payments on that. The seller did a wrongful foreclosure using 6675 without a power of sale, although she had a mortgage. And then she took the property at the sale and resold it for $1.4 million. Had the court in Santiago applied conversion damages, the Santiago's would have been entitled to the fair market value, which is the resale of $1.4 million. But the court says, no, we're going to give you more than that. We're going to give you everything that you paid, including your property taxes and your mortgage payments and the closing costs, and the damages that the Santiago received exceeded the $1.4 million. But what the court is saying is that you do have to offset whatever you might have received in exchange for what you parted with. In our case, we received nothing in exchange. We were left with that mortgage. The Lima court even says that the remedy is whatever you received at the time of the wrongful foreclosure, the debt that was eliminated, you have to recover and set that off against the property that was taken from you. It is the out-of-pocket rule requires what you loss to be offset by what you received in return. In our case, we didn't receive anything in return for that mortgage.
Can you come back to the question I asked originally, which is plaintiff borrowers must show the damages they seek will restore them to the position they would be in if the wrong had not been committed. At the time the wrong was committed, he owed more money than the property was worth. So how is the rule you're arguing for restoring your client to position he would be in absent the wrong?
But the mortgage was not owed to the association. The mortgage was owed to a third party. It's no different. The damage remedy is no different from where property is taken by fraud or forgery. If you were to say, well, at the time that the property was stolen from you by fraud or forgery, it was encumbered by a mortgage, and therefore you had no equity, then you haven't suffered any loss. It's the same situation with the association. They had no right to do what they did, yet they took the property and sold it. So, well, why is there a difference? Public policy compels that you discourage wrongdoing. You don't encourage wrongdoing. If you were to say that in any fraud or wrongful taking situation where you've got property that's underwater, there's no damages, you're going to encourage people to commit fraud. It's not unforeseeable that you could have a homeowner with a mortgage who needs financing and can't get financing from a traditional source. They're going to go to a non-traditional lender. And that non-traditional lender I had a case 15 years ago in Judge McKenna, where the Wakamura case, where the lender took advantage of that homeowner. And that's what's going to happen. You're going to have homeowners who go to non-traditional lenders, and they're going to take advantage of that homeowner and say, huh, you've got no equity in your property. I'm going to take your property. I'm going to rent it out until that lender comes and forecloses. That cannot be the policy of the law. The public policy compels that wrongdoers be discouraged.
What about the rental value of the property? We alluded to it earlier, and I think you talk about it at the very end of your opening brief. If that were an appropriate measure of damages, what would that look like? What should that look like in your point of view, and what are the pros and cons of that?
Well, 8 years of rental income was $300,000. That's what we estimated to be, versus the $400,000 mortgage that with interest increase. At the time of the foreclosure sale, the property sold for $576,000. So if you're looking 8 years down the road to do these offsets or to do this accounting, you have to take into account that the property had appreciated in value.
The costs that might have been reasonably incurred by the association, such as the fees that would have been paid or should have been paid by the occupant of the unit, other charges that might typically be imposed on the person who owns the unit. Should those be deducted?
Certainly, if you're recovering the rental income, you would have to pay the cost to the association for the common expenses. Let me remind the court, if I may, that the association did not have to do this non-judicial foreclosure. Right, they had a land that was subject to that was junior to a senior mortgage. They could have simply filed suit they could have filed a collection action. And in fact, that is what the law at the time required, because they did not have the right to use part one, 6675, because they did not hold a mortgage. They elected not to use part two, which I thought they had the right to use, you know, because I thought the legislature had given them the right to use part two, even without a power of sale. But they could have just filed a collection action and obtained a judgment, and they didn't have to do what they did.
I'm looking at Restatement Second of Torts, Section 927, governing conversion. Basically, it says when one is entitled to judgment for conversion of a legally protected interest in land, he may recover either the value of the subject matter or of his interest in it at the time and place of the conversion, as well as, you know, compensation for the loss of use not otherwise compensated.
Yeah, I was thinking.
So, it, you know, the restatement torts is saying you get your interest in what was taken, the full market value when you were completely underwater.
So in a case of fraud or forgery, we get nothing because we
have no, that's not what we're saying. In addition, it is what the compensation for the loss of use. And that is why I'm suggesting that the loss of use appears to be for the, you know, until the first lender foreclosed, because your client was underwater at the time. Why should you get the windfall? And if, when you're looking at the restatement second, you're not entitled to it. You get your loss of use damages, which appears to be the rent. And that's why I'm asking you again, are you agreeing that what they received was the fair market value, or do you know what they received in rent?
We didn't receive anything.
I'm asking you, do you know what they received in rent? And if so, are you agreeing that that is what the fair market rental or the value of the use of that property would have been?
I do, John.
All right.
I do, yeah. But I would like to submit that the restatement deals with a lot of cases that have deeds of trust, not mortgages. And so you need to look carefully at whether the restatement on property, real property, really applies to Hawaii. And you see that my light is on, so I'm going to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Chung. All right, Ms. Markin, your argument.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Chief Justice Recknwald, Justice McKenna, Justice Eddins, Judge Wong, Judge Somerville, thank you for taking the time to hear our case. May it please the court, my name is Mary Martin, and I am one of the attorneys for the Association of Apartment Owners. With me is co-counsel Carlos Perez Mesa, and the attorneys for the third-party defendant appellees are also present. James Shin is here representing one of the law firms, and Dwayne Miyashiro representing the other law firm. We thank you for taking the transfer to this court. It was supposed to be heard by the ICA, but when the Rubalcaba decision—
Could you move the mic down just a little bit, please? This will help us get a better set. Thank you.
Okay. When the Rubalcaba reserve question came up, both sides in this part in this litigation asked for the case to be transferred here, and this court said yes and decided that it would respond to the Rubalcaba question in the context of this case. The context of this case with Mr. Wong has the benefit of the distinction of bringing a factually developed record to this court, as opposed to the appeal from a motion to dismiss, which was the case in both Malaba and Sakal. In this case, the plaintiff, Mr. Wong, is or was an investor. His first properties were given to him by his mother in 2002, 2003 with small mortgages on them. He financed those properties a number of times over the years. In 2005, he purchased unit 1601 at Harbor Square, including the sandwich lease, for which the total purchase price was $503,697. To finance that, he came up with an initial cash payment of $100,000 and took out a mortgage for $420,750. He refinanced that mortgage a year later for $450,000. To this day, Mr. Wong has not identified the source of the $100,000. He testified inconsistently. At one point, he said he borrowed it from somebody.
How is that relevant? How is that relevant to the issues of
because
this case?
it becomes into the element of damages because he has no proof of borrowing that money nor of repaying it. It's a loan. It was not out of his pocket. Between borrowing the money for the down payment and borrowing the mortgage.
Is he claiming that separately as damages in this case, his down payment?
I'm sorry?
Is he claiming that as damages in this case, the down payment he made initially? I thought he's asking for the entire value of the property.
He is. But the point we're making is that between all of the loans, which were never repaid, he's way underwater. And it goes into that whole calculation. He has no proof that he ever paid back those monies. He eventually defaulted, not just on this property. I'm sorry. I want to include something else. I'm sorry. Mr. Wong didn't live there. He rented the property out completely. When he purchased the property, there were renters in there paying $2,400 a month.
How much did you rent it for?
I don't know. It never came up. The question was not asked. It hasn't been determined. There's no evidence in the record that establishes what the association was able to rent the unit for once it foreclosed. But when Mr. Wong started renting it, it was at $2,400. Once that lease ran out, he rented it for $3,300. And according to his testimony, his mortgage payments were $2,400. His payments to the association were $975. So that $3,300 should have covered all of his carrying, the most part of his carrying expenses. However, in 2009, he quit paying the association. That's problematic because the board of directors has a fiduciary duty to the entire association to keep up the maintenance, to pay whatever repairs and everything else that has to be done on the building. And if owners stop paying, then the association does not have the funds to be able to finance things, or the other owners have to subsidize this person that's no longer paying.
Ms. Martin, if you could engage on the question of Lima's applicability to this case, which I asked Mr. Chung about. Mr. Chung responded, very distinct situation. There was a bank. The bank in Lima was the foreclosing party, and your client or the association here was not. And that's the key distinction. And that seemed to weigh very heavily in the mind of the circuit court. Could you tell us what you think the correct approach to that issue is?
I'm sorry. I have a little bit of a hearing issue.
Okay. What about Lima and its applicability to this case?
Lima's applicability, that's what I'm going to get to. But let me get there because we have the underwater calculation. And I'd like to also make the point.
I think it makes sense to respond to the Chief Justice's question directly.
Lima, I mean, we're trying to get to the crux. And I think, you know, we sort of did that with Mr. Chung. So please help us get to the crux of the matter as we see it, which might be the applicability of Lima. Okay. Yes or no?
Lima applies for several reasons. And we get it directly from the quotes from Lima. Lima, of course, as this court knows, was a unanimous decision certified question from the district court, in which the specific question that was asked was, is the effect of the mortgage considered only as a matter of set off that a lender has the burden of proving after the borrower establishes the amount of the borrower's damages? Or does a borrower with no pre-foreclosure rights in property, except as encumbered by a mortgage, bear the burden of accounting for the effect of the mortgage in establishing the element of harm in a liability case? And as court stated, under Hawaii law, a borrower with no pre-foreclosure rights in property, except as encumbered by a mortgage, bears the burden of accounting for the effect of the mortgage in establishing the element of harm. That's exactly what we have here. Mr. There's an, let me, we're bulging into another part, but let me continue here. In Lima, the court specifically identified the elements of the claims, both requiring proofs of damages. The two claims were wrongful nonjudicial foreclosure and unfair and deceptive acts and practices. And this court stated the elements of the claims and said it's axiomatic that plaintiffs bear the burden of establishing all necessary elements of the claims. And one of those elements is the element of damages. When you look at this, at the point that Mr. Wong was foreclosed by the association, or when he went into default, he was already underwater. At that point in time, the unit was supposedly worth $448,000, but he owed $440,000 on the principal of the mortgage and $40,000 of interest, plus the $29,000 that he owed to the association at that time. So he was effectively underwater. He was in a negative $60,000 approximately as a pre-foreclosure interest to this property, and he was unable to pay. When he was notified by the association to bring it current, he was under the threat of foreclosure. He didn't respond. He didn't try and negotiate with the association. He didn't try and loan modification.
You know, Ms. Martin, you know, the Chief Justice asked you basically, how is it distinct from, you know, how is Lima distinct? When Mr. Chung was basically saying, hey, look, it's different when you have the third party mortgagee foreclosing versus, you know, the other situation. That's the distinction that we want to try to address here now, okay?
Okay, well, there's two elements to answer that question. One is the element of time, because Mr. Wong didn't file this lawsuit until years later. So by that time, the bank had started its foreclosure as well. And as a practical matter, he avoided participating in the bank's foreclosure. He was served by publication, didn't respond, so he was defaulted. And so the bank had to proceed without naming Mr. Wong.
But, okay, we're just trying to figure out what's the difference for damages. Why does Lima apply on damages versus what Mr. Chung is arguing that Lima doesn't apply based on the distinguishing characteristic or quality of a bank foreclosing versus the AOAO foreclosure?
Well, at this day and time, Your Honor, the issue is, where did things stand at the time that he filed his lawsuit?
Okay, so now we're at the pre-tort litigation. That's where we want to be. Let me ask you this. As far as out-of-pocket losses, and we're looking at pre-tort damages, what year's fair market value should be considered, and what year's mortgage debt should be considered, in your view?
I believe it can be considered at either time, because in either point in time in this case, he was at a negative balance. We know that he was at a negative when the association foreclosed. By the time the bank foreclosed in 2016
So what should a court decide? Should it be 2011, fair market value and mortgage balance, or 2019 or 2020? For fair market value mortgage balance?
Well, what is your position? As a practical matter, the fair market value in 2023 or 2019, when he filed the lawsuit, didn't vary very much. In fact, and I'm going based on the tax records, because it's not in the, there's nothing in the pleadings that establish what fair market value was other than at the time of the foreclosure. But that value at that time was the tax assessed, happened to be equivalent to the tax assessed value.
You're probably saying that he's underwater either way, but what should the court use? What date is it? If we're talking about pre-tort, you know, litigation, it might be 2011, but is it possibly the other? Is it possibly when the third party mortgagee forecloses and there's final judgment on that?
The practical, and I don't want to avoid your question on a specific answer to that, but the practical application or response is that the value of the unit, the value of the property, was always underwater, because the amount that he owed continued to grow to almost $800,000 by the time it was the bank foreclosed, and the sale was for $576,000. And the tax assessed value, if I recall from research, was about that amount.
Let me ask you this. Let's say we, as a court, rule that the calculations for the losses are at the time of the wrongful foreclosure, 2011. Fair market value, whatever the mortgage balance was there. Why should Wong have his recovery, you know, offset by, you know, 9 years of, or 8 years, whatever it may be, of not having rental income, not having the ability to live there?
Well, at the time of the association's foreclosure, the value was only $448,000, and he had no pre-foreclosure interest in the property at that time. So had this lawsuit been filed back then, he still would have lost, because he had a negative equity in it. Had the foreclosure been challenged at that time, the bank would have still had its mortgage on the property. It still would have remained underwater.
What's your response to the suggestion that Mr. Wong should be able to recover the rental value of the property from 2011 until the foreclosure in 2019?
Well, number one, he didn't ask for that. But in any case, you're talking about his asking for conversion type damages. And those would probably put him in a better position than he would have been if he'd gotten, than he deserved to get at the time of the foreclosure. But there was no evidence in the record, nothing to show that there were conversion damages, that the association had actually fully rented it for that entire period of time, and no amount that the association rented it for. So we have no basis to try and establish those damages.
What about the $3,300 that he was renting it for?
Well, that's what Mr. Wong was renting it for.
Yes.
And as a practical matter, Mr. Wong, even after he defaulted, he continued to rent the unit for $3,300 a month without paying the bank and without paying the association. He pocketed almost $79,200 over the 2 years.
Ms. Martin, isn't that the case where a person's either renting it out or living there in this wide gap before there is a lawful foreclosure? I mean, isn't that just what would happen? And even if the bank comes in later to foreclose, he would have been able to do that. I mean,
but Your Honor, he would have had to been paying the association at that time, and he'd stopped doing it. Technically, as you're asking, it raises an interesting point, because if the bank had not foreclosed, because the bank didn't foreclose at that time, arguably, the association could have either tried to collect rents from itself from the renter, but that would have required under 514B145 that the association had adopted a policy by a majority of the owners to do that kind of collection. On the other side.
Okay, but we're just talking about damages. So yes, you're right, is you'd be entitled to, you know, whatever association fees, whatever that monthly fee is, that $29,000 that he owed and all that, but he would be entitled, don't you think, to that rental income, less what he owes you. And aside from what he might have owed the third party lender, they didn't foreclose, that was on them.
I'm not sure I understand the question, but the fact is that had the association not pursued its foreclosure and let him continue to live there, the association might have tried to collect from the bank, as in many mortgages at that time, and I presume still now, the mortgages on condominium properties include a clause saying that if the person is not paying their condominium fees, the condo association can make a demand to the lender to ask for payment of those fees. That wouldn't have happened here because Mr. Wong wasn't paying the bank. So there's no way the association could make itself whole without proceeding to foreclose and rent the unit for whatever it was able to do. A fact that we don't know how that played out monetarily, because there was no discovery sought on that issue.
Applying the restatement principles that Justice McKenna alluded to, I mean, why would it not be a fair and appropriate measure of damages to allow Mr. Wong to recover the rental value of that property less the amounts that he owed the association for fees or any other assessments.
We have some thoughts on that, Your Honor. And I refer to my notes. Beg your pardon. First, there was no argument asking for that.
Was there nothing in the record? Was there no admissible evidence in the record to indicate that the property had been rented by the association for those 8 years or so?
There is one piece in the record that refers to the fact that the association no longer rented the unit after the bank had foreclosed and ordered the unit to be sold. But up till that, there's no indication as to how many months or for what amount it was sold.
Because your motion was asserting that the plaintiff could not prove compensatory damages. Is that right?
That's right.
And in response, his position was, we get the value of the property.
I'm sorry.
He took the position that he's entitled to the value of the property, and that was the measure of damages. And rent was not, and the circuit court found that there was no evidence with respect to the actual rent.
Well, number one, Mr. Wong didn't ask for the rentals, so he would have to go back and amend. But we posit that the...
Was trial set at the time of this these MSJs? Like, was there a trial date?
I'm sorry?
Was there a trial date at the time? I mean, I know your motion was filed, in January of 2022. How close were we to trial?
I don't believe we had a trial date. Mr. Chung is not going to help me out on that one. Because once the Lima ruling came out, the association took Mr. Wong's deposition and proceeded to check and ask about his damages. Because the Lima case spoke directly to the two claims that were alleged in the complaint, one being the wrongful non-judicial foreclosure, and the other one being the UDAP claim. And the elements he couldn't prove.
You indicated that there was one paper that talked about you had stopped renting it. Where was that? Where did that appear?
I'm sorry, where was what?
You said that there was something in the record informing the court that you had stopped renting the property at the time of the first mortgagee's foreclosure. I'm just wondering where that is in the record.
I believe it's in his deposition that he continued to collect the rent.
Is the deposition in the record?
Yes, it is. It's attached to our summary judgment motion that was filed in January of 2022?
Yes, thank you.
Yes, it is definitely in there. Further to the application here, besides the fact that Mr. Wong could not, at his deposition or in response to the summary judgment motion, and he didn't dispute any of the facts at the summary judgment motion, summary judgment was therefore granted based on the court's reading of the Lima case. He couldn't prove any of the out-of-his-pocket expenses, The burden had shifted to him to proceed that way. At one point, let's talk about the other
options. Well, can I just finish up one question on this issue of the rents? I think I'm just looking at Mr. Chung's opening brief. And in essence, if I understand his argument on this point, is that it would have been a surprise to him and his client that they would not be able to recover the full value of the property, and it would be a change in law as they understood it. Therefore, if we do change the law in that way, to say that they cannot recover the value of the property because of the bank's mortgage, that they should be able to recover the rental value. What's your answer to that argument? I'm anticipating what he's going to say, and of course I'll ask him this question too.
I don't believe that question was raised below, is my first answer to that question.
So in essence, you're saying it's waived. The argument that there's an entitlement to rental income is waived.
I'm sorry?
Your argument is that any claim for rental income was waived.
You have to realize, Your Honor, that at the time that the bank filed its foreclosure action in 2016, which was 4.5 years after the association had foreclosed, and of course the association had no idea that it was going to take that long, but at that time, Mr. Wong had been approached by Mr. Chung already with the idea of filing the instant lawsuit that he didn't file until 2019. They made a conscientious decision at that time to avoid the bank's foreclosure, not participate in it and avoid it in order to be, and this is in his brief, they avoided participation in that foreclosure knowing that the remedy would have been to have rescission, and going back to the point where he was pre-foreclosure would have left him back in the hole and without the unit. He would have lost it. And they made the concerted decision to pursue the value of the property at the time that the bank or that the association had foreclosed. In fact, they avoided when the association filed a motion for consolidation with the bank's foreclosure, which was still going at the same time as this case below. It was vigorously opposed. They definitely wanted to stay away from having to deal with that particular aspect of the case.
When you say deal with that aspect, could you just explain to me what, in your view, they were trying to avoid?
In Mr. Wong's fear, and I believe it's stated in his opening brief, page 27, if I remember correctly, they realized that the bank foreclosure was going on, but they made the decision to avoid it in order to avoid having to get into the argument and what remedy would be available at that time, because they could have cross-claimed at that time and filed a claim against the association, which was a party to that lawsuit. And there was out of that lawsuit because the association at the time of confirming the sale asked that there be no deficiency. And of course, by that time, Model M was in the books, and that kept it from, that was a damper on anybody's pursuing a deficiency judgment. We'd like to talk a little bit about the Rubalcaba case because it is on the similar grounds and asks a very open question. That case comes also on a wrongful non-judicial foreclosure under Part 1, and presumably most of these other outstanding cases or pending cases are in the same place. The question is going to be in each one of those is, are there out-of-pocket damages? And so all of those cases were filed in 2021 or 2022, which means it's at least 10 years or so since Part 1 and Part 2 have been unavailable to associations for that long. Either the banks have foreclosed or they're pending foreclosures. We've looked at some of them. Some of them were foreclosed quickly. Some of them were not. But they'll have to deal with the out-of-pocket damages. So the answer to the Rubalcaba question should be the same answer that was given in Lima to the U.S. District Court. that it should, that the outstanding mortgage should apply. Had the association filed under or pursued their foreclosure under part two, it was unworkable. And this court, of course, since then in Malabi said that wasn't an option unless it's in your books. And to file a judicial foreclosure would have meant that the bank would still hold its mortgage because the association can't force the bank to its remedy. The association had no way to make itself mortgage and equity to the rest of the owners unless it had foreclosed because Mr. Wong just was not paying his fair share. This court should follow its damage analysis in Lima because there is no rational distinction between a lender's non-judicial foreclosure and the association non-judicial foreclosure for purposes of a plaintiff's burden to prove his own damages in the case in chief. Lima relied on Santiago, a commercial landlord-tenant dispute involving seller financing, for the proposition that courts must apply a set-off in determining the borrower's injuries and damages. The Ninth Circuit, the Lima case went back to the federal court and was affirmed, and Judge Mulway dismissed those cases across the board shortly after this court's ruling. All of them were appealed to the Ninth Circuit. They have all been affirmed. Well, the Weinberg case, which is a Ninth Circuit earlier case, and I can provide the citation if the court would like that. The defendants met their burden of proof. They showed that there was no damages. The burden shifted to Mr. Wong to show that he had damages, and he had to come forward with evidence to show that he had damages, a genuine issue of material fact. He didn't. He didn't dispute any of the facts that were alleged in the summary judgment motion.
Wouldn't he say that absent the wrongful foreclosure, he would have been in possession of the unit and could have rented it out?
Effectively, yes. And pocketing the money all along without paying the association and without paying the bank.
Right. So there should be, if that's a measure of damages, there should be a deduction for the amounts he owed the association for fees and costs, correct?
That would be a consideration, but in fact, the facts are that he didn't do that, so it hasn't been raised as an issue, but it would be.
Okay, so say he hadn't waived it, or say one of the Rubalcaba defendants, or plaintiffs rather, had brought up the rental issue. Are they entitled to that less the AOAO fees, the assessments, all those statutory credit, excise tax, all those.
It may be a case-by-case basis because we don't know the specific facts of those cases. All we know is that they were brought under the same statutes. And if the Lima rules of you must prove your damages, then leave it to them to their proof. If they can't prove them, they shouldn't be able to extract funds and a remedy out of the association.
Well, anything further at this point? Ms. Martin, you're up to your half hour, but I'm happy to let you wrap up briefly if there's something you wish to
share. I understand. Thank you, Your Honor.
No, anything further at this point?
No.
Very well.
Up again?
Mr. Chung, your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, I submit that Lima and Johnson versus Tisdale say the same thing. When there's a wrongful taking, the plaintiff is entitled to the value of what was taken less what is owed to the creditor that did the wrongful taking. In the Lima case, it turned out to be the lender that had the mortgages on the property, and the mortgages were of greater value than the property. That's why no damages. In our case, the creditor is the association, not the mortgagee, and the amount of debt that was eliminated is a dollar that they paid for the property. We didn't have any debt eliminated at the time of the wrongful taking, so we're entitled to the value of the property, less perhaps what we're owed for the association deals.
You didn't argue for the rents below?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You did not argue for the rentals that...
We did not, because the conversion damages require an election. We had to elect either the value of the property or conversion damages.
Actually, it's your interest in the property, as I indicated, pursuant to the restatement second of torts. It's not the value of the property. It's your the value of your interest in the property, which appears to be zero.
Well, I submit, Your Honor, that the Johnson court says the fair market value of the property.
Johnson, which Johnson, court is that?
Johnson versus Tisdale. And it was a chattel mortgage, but the Johnson court says the same ruling would apply if this were a tract of land. And so we're adhering to the established precedent. We're entitled to the whole value of the property, the fair market value of the property, less what is owed to the association. That's the precedent that we're following, and we have to make a choice. You either get the return of the property, or you say keep it and let the lender foreclose. You deal with it because you took it. You know, we'll take the value of the property.
What about the restatement rule? Doesn't the restatement rule seem like sound policy? Well, the value of your interest in the property.
I would submit that policy comes under these deed of trust states, and you have different
rules. I'm sorry,
rules.
I couldn't.
Deed of trust.
Maybe you'll raise the mic up.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I submit that the restatement follows the deed of trust states, and you have difference when you give a deed of trust and you transfer title to the lender to secure the debt. And you have a different situation here in Hawaii where you've mortgaged the property, where you still own the property and you just have a lien on the property. And so the restatement I would submit is inapplicable or should be distinguished because of the different circumstances. You know, the majority of the law dealing with wrongful foreclosures arose in deed of trust states, jurisdictions. And it wasn't until first the Johnson Tisdale case and then Santiago case, which dealt with real property, that we have Hawaii law that deals with the subject. But Santiago says, you know, you get all of your out-of-pocket losses, and we submit that out-of-pocket losses does not mean cash that you earn and you pay, as the respondents are arguing. We submit that out-of-pocket loss is the value of what you have, whether you obtained it by gift or by financing or by money that you earned. That's your value of the property that you lost.
So would you agree that you waived any claim to rental income from the property?
We did, because we elected the fair market value.
All right. So if we hold that you're not entitled to fair market value, is that the end of this case?
Well, we submit that we're changing the rules. And if we're going to change the rules, then we have to change the remedy. And we also submit that this issue, to the extent that the court feels that it's an association that is trying to exercise the duty to collect rent and it's not fair to the other homeowners, that's a legislative issue. It's not for the court to legislate. It's for the legislature to change the rules if that's what they understand is necessary. Because the things that you need to consider are, well, how does this ruling apply when you've got fraud or forgery or some guy buying a car that's fully financed and gets into a wreck and the car is worth less than the amount of the financing? Are you going to say, well, the defendant, you're home free because there was no equity, there was the owner was underwater, so you have no damages, you're home free? And that cannot be the law. That cannot be the policy of the law. We need to discourage wrongdoing, and to the extent that a plaintiff such as my clients obtain a benefit, a windfall, if you will, that's just the policy of the law, because they're not the wrongdoers. It's the wrongdoer
who should suffer the recovery of rent less amounts owed to the association be a deterrent to the association?
It probably would. If that's the remedy that the court will, on a going forward basis, require us to seek.
Well, anything further for the court at this time?
No, I don't, Your Honor. I appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you. Thank you.
All right. Thank you both, Ms. Martin and Mr. Chung, for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Ku iluna, please rise. Ua ho'oku'u ia mai ne kea aha ho'okolo kolo ki'iki hanahano o ka moku'aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.